What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Check the Kick Podcast. I'm the host, Devin. SureDog.com is the website. Pretty interesting weekend of fights and some semi-interesting fights coming up, but we'll get trucking through this because week after this one, we got UFC 300. And I mean, if you're not planted on your couch from start to finish on that card, you're missing out. This UFC Atlantic City card was tied for the most knockouts, and I'm telling you, every single one of them has an asterisk on them. Very interesting. And we'll just get right into it. Manon Fiorot, or I guess it's Fior now. I'm going to just say Fiorot until she fights a fight that really, really makes me care. Yes, I'm hating. She defeats Erin Blanchfield 50-45 on all three cards. And there could have been two rounds that you scored for Blanchfield there. And this was a fight that really, unfortunately, I picked Erin Blanchfield going into that fight. I thought Blanchfield would be able to pressure Manon against the cage with a jab and then, you know, get some wrestling going. But I was mistaken because this was the J.J. Aldridge fight. It was almost a J.J. Aldridge fight, exactly, even with, you know, the high elbow guillotine that Erin Blanchfield is so known for. Manon looked good. I'm going to say it. Manon looked good, but I'll put a star next to that because, yes, she defeated a highly touted prospect in Erin Blanchfield. Erin Blanchfield ended up being like a 2-1 favorite by the time this fight closed out. Saturday before the fight started, Manon looked good, but Erin Blanchfield got really exposed, in my opinion. Number one, she may just be too small for 125. And if you look at her, of course, she's in shape. She's a pro fighter, and I'm no one to talk about someone's shape unless you round is a shape. But yeah, for her, she just seemed to be, I don't want to say outgunned, but in a lot of the tie-ups, Manon just shucked her off. There was a couple moments where Blanchfield would come pressuring in. And I have a lot to say about this fight, and I will. Blanchfield would come pressuring in. They'd get into a clinch, and Manon would just, boom, just flick her off to the side. You know, kind of if same thing I would do to like a 14-year-old, you know, just pick him up and throw him out of the way. And that's kind of what it looked like here. Blanchfield, for such a high-level grappler, because she's not a wrestler, she's a grappler, high-level BJJ, very, very high-level BJJ. In the first round where Manon picked her up and threw her to the ground, that's where she got put into that, you know, very dicey guillotine, potential guillotine. Obviously, Manon fought her way out. This is a fight where Manon's 34, Blanchfield's 24, 10-year age gap. So maybe Blanchfield can, you know, hit the weights and grow into her body and become stronger and more powerful. But when you look at Blanchfield, I hate to tell a pro fighter that they're not in shape because obviously she's in shape. She just, you know, went five rounds and gave it her all. But I feel like she could probably make 115. I don't know if that's the best thing for her, because she was able to hang in there with Tyler Santos, who is a giant women's flyweight that's super physical, super strong. I just don't know. After this performance, Erin, she's still young. You know, she's 10 years younger than Manon Fiorot. So there's definitely still room for improvement for Erin. But there was just a lot of technical deficiencies that, you know, I'm playing armchair quarterback watching this fight off, you know, sitting on my couch. But it is my job to come here and tell you guys how I feel about it. So that's what I'm doing. What I noticed from Manon Fiorot, what she did well, her outside footwork is always good. Her check right hook. I definitely think she's a right-handed fighter fighting southpaw, something like Dustin Poirier, but I'm not going to compare Manon Fiorot to Dustin Poirier. Only thing that they have similar is I believe that they're right-hand fighters fighting southpaw. Anytime Blanchfield would enter the pocket, Manon would try to escape out, cut an angle, hit her with that check right hook, which is a good punch and a smart punch to throw as a southpaw to someone that is just blindly entering the pocket. Footwork looked good. Her strength is there. Manon's cardio held up, which I was surprised because she looked fucking terrible on the scale. She said she wants a title fight. I don't know if she's going to get it. Probably get stuck fighting. She's not going to fight Rose again, but I would not be surprised if they offered her Macy Barber. Just because I don't think Manon is ever going to be. I mean, we got Steve Erceg. Shout out to him because he's actually a very good fighter. But she might just be like the Steve Erceg here in this division, where we, you know, not a lot of people just care. Not much fanfare. Blanchfield's tactics in this fight. She probably just needs to go. I hate to say, I don't like to tell fighters to go to a different camp, but like, you need to go to a camp that's going to, number one, you need to learn how to wrestle. If there was one entry where she got Manon down, where she entered the pocket beautifully. And she does that same, you know, inside step, double underhook, cut the angle and get the trip takedown, a la Henry Cejudo. Henry Cejudo hit that on DJ. It's a Henry Cejudo move. And that's what her takedown game is. A lot of upper body locks with trips and stuff like that. In women's MMA, that's going to work. And that's going to get you all the way up to where it got her. But, you know, you need to have more of a takedown game. She doesn't even need a blast double, but if you're going to be a grappler, you need to go about it in two ways. You need to take the Pantoja route, where you are going to smash someone against the cage, cause them to give their back, and then take their back, which would be something that I would like to see Blanchfield do, really try to press people against the cage and maybe work in a back take game. Or she needs to develop like some single legs. You don't have to be. And why I say single legs is because, you know, someone that likes to utilize trips and stuff like that, a single leg takedown is almost perfect for that. Get the low single, elevate the leg, and then kick the other leg out and then win the scramble, because she's going to win a lot of scrambles against a lot of girls. You know, go hang out with DC, or go. Just go spend a couple weeks with Marab. Hey, dude, please teach me how to spam these takedowns. I don't need your cardio. Erin Blanchfield just got stranded on an island out there, where she was just forced to blitz in the pocket. Manon would just skirt on the outside, counterpunch her. And instead of just taking the counterpunch and then prolonging the exchange, which she started to do towards the later rounds of the fight and had success, because, you know, something that I saw on the tape, and anyone that watches Manon Fiorot tape, is when exchanges get, when there's prolonged exchanges in the pocket and Manon has to, she can't just be the counterpuncher that plants her feet really quick, hits her with that check hook and then backs out. If you cause her to exchange more than that, she doesn't like it. There's moments in this fight where Erin Blanchfield would pressure, land something, you know, and Manon, you could just tell like she didn't love it. Even at the end of this fight, Manon landed a lot more of the cleaner strikes, but Blanchfield's tenacity, she wasn't bothered by anything. Manon looked to be more bothered by Blanchfield's strikes when they got landed, especially when she was pressuring. Like, Manon just doesn't, it just puts her out of place, and Blanchfield just mentally is not one that you're going to, you know, you're just not going to break Blanchfield. And we saw that this weekend. She went and lost every single round and was still trying her hardest. And that's going to be something that someone's going to expose, you know, on Fiero, someone like Grasso that can just get on the front foot and push forward, and will have those prolonged pocket exchanges. But that's potentially down the line. Blanchfield, her inability to enter the pocket as well. She was just stranded on an island. Her takedown game was kind of non-existent in this fight because she doesn't have that tool in her belt. And this was just kind of like shades of the Lupi Godinez and Vina Zhangidoba fight, where if you're the smaller fighter, you can't just stay at range and get picked apart and then blitz into the pocket, eat a jab, eat a check hook, and then reset. Like, you need to continue to go, or you need to feint your way in. Feint. Draw that check hook out of men on Fiorot, and then crush the pocket with your takedowns. I liked what Blanchfield was doing. She was throwing ones and twos. They were just outside of range because Manon was backing up. And then she would boom, throw the body kick. Boom, throw the body kick. Like, that was nice. But, like, maybe throw a 4 or 5 punch combo. Feint your way in. Draw that first shot out of Manon. You know, then throw a 3 or 4 punch combination. And then land with, you know, and then end with the kick to the body. She can go back to the drawing board. She's 24. She's not going to be discouraged. She even posted on her social media. I'm recording this on Monday, April 1st, April Fools. She posted on her social media saying something along the lines of, you know, tough night at the office. I'll be back. And she'll be back. I mean, she's 24. Whether she decides to stay in this division or go down, I think if she stays in this division, she really, really needs to work on feints, entering the pocket, her tenacity. It's just something that has not been taught to her. It's one of those things as a fighter and anything in life, you know, you have to do something so many times to eventually become good at it. You know, outside of this MMA stuff and my personal job, I'm a fisherman. Look at my handle. It's right there. I'm a major fisherman, and I've been fishing. I mean, I've been watching MMA for 20 years, and I've been fishing for 30. I've been fishing since I was a very, very young child, a toddler. And I'm still learning things every single time I go, and I'm still honing my craft, and I'll never be the best at it. I feel like I'm good at it, but I'm good at it because I've put in tons and tons and tons of hours. And that's the same thing, you know, as being an MMA fighter. You just have to put in all of that time. And there's still a lot of time left for Blanchfield. She's 24. So can she go to a gym, you know, like Henry Hoof's gym, and really learn, get broken down and built back up to become a better striker? Yes. Can she go to a gym like AKA and really just learn some standard grappling, like some just some wrestling? Yes, she can totally do that. And her tenacity's there. Her BJJ is there. And she does have some decent striking when she wants to. So I think just a little bit more time in the workshop. You know, I say by 27, we might see a whole different Erin Blanchfield. And I could be, you know, in 3 years from now, I could be eating all the crow in the world. As for her, I know I'm talking about her more than Manon, because this was, you know, I picked Erin Blanchfield. But if you picked Manon to win this fight, which a lot of people did, my colleagues, Ben and Keith, both did, and they were spot on. And Manon Fiorot winning this fight was going to look just like this. So, like, I wasn't surprised. The best thing for Manon Fiorot is that she's French, because if she was just another random American fighter, I mean, God, she's on like a 7-fight win streak. And like, I personally still don't care. I hate to say that. Erin Blanchfield, moving forward, she needs a comeback fight. She should go take like 6 months off, 8 months off, go hone some skills. Maybe they could match her up with someone like Viviane Araújo, or not Macy Barber. You don't want to bang your toys against each other. I like Viviane Araújo. Rose Namajunas makes a lot of sense, even though she's coming off a loss. Rose has got one win in the division, and it's against Amanda Hibosh. I mean, I guess Amanda Hibosh could make a lot of sense. So any of those three fights for me are okay. I'd be totally fine with that. And then for Manon Fiorot, she's stuck in a real shitty situation, because Tough is being recorded probably right now as we speak. And we are set for a trilogy between Grasso and Shevchenko. You'd assume that fight may happen like in the Sphere on Mexican Independence Day. And I think they're trying to record this Ultimate Fighter expeditiously. I don't know what season this is. This is season fucking 60. Who knows? They don't know why they're still doing this. I feel like they have some TV rights with ESPN that they need to fill some time slots. So that's probably why they're doing this, because, I mean, forever, I would say I'd rather watch Dana White's Contender Series, but now I know the format of the Contender Series, and they're just like, yeah, here's your contract. You know, you want to you won a regional MMA fight under a UFC banner. Here's your UFC contract. That's neither here nor there. Manon Fiorot is stuck in a bad spot, though. The division is, I mean, they have yanked the e-brake on this division with this Ultimate Fighter being recorded. Probably July they'll fight for it. Manon's 34. She stated that she wants a title fight. If Shevchenko wins, which is, you know, don't want to call robbery. We're going to call robbery in a little bit, but you don't want to call robbery on that rematch, but Shevchenko probably kind of clearly won it. And if it wasn't for a bad 10-8 scorecard, she would have. So it ends in a draw. Grasso retains via draw. And if Shevchenko wins, Shevchenko can easily say, hey, second fight, draw. I got shafted. I beat you cleanly this time. I'm going to go fight Raquel Pennington for the bantamweight title. If Shevchenko beats Grasso, I really feel like she's going to go up there hunting for that women's bantamweight title fight. And the UFC would totally grant it. It's Valentina Shevchenko. So if that happens, Manon is probably not fighting for a real title in this division, and she'll probably end up fighting Grasso or like Barber for an interim title. And then she'll be like over 35 at that point. And it's WMMA, so I don't even know if that stat matters, realistically. Yeah, this division is just all, they were doing so good. They're doing so good. And now it's just all out of whack. Decent fight from Manon Fiorot. Didn't win any fans over, but you know, if you won some money on her as an underdog, good for you. And Erin Blanchfield, she'll be back. We're going to go ahead and bump down to the co-main event. We have Joaquin Buckley winning via stoppage. First round stoppage, I called that. Didn't really call it like this, so I can't take all the credit. Over Vicente Luque. I guess now to have a great performance, you need to go to a pool party in March in Atlantic City. Sure as hell looked like an outdoor pool party. I don't know if you guys saw this, but Joaquin Buckley is his own hype man. The dude has more confidence than John Jones. It is hilarious. And we like Joaquin Buckley here. He's a very fun fighter. And Vicente Luque probably shouldn't fight anymore. I'm just going to say it. I don't want to tell people to call, you know, people don't tell me to quit my job. However, man, Buckley looked great and Luque looked bad. What Buckley did well, he is a short, stocky guy. He was significantly smaller than Vicente Luque here. And I don't call Luque as, Luque is a big guy, but he's not big. You know, there are bigger welterweights than him. Buckley even looks smaller than him here, which is interesting because he's coming down from 85. And Buckley's angle cutting was great in this fight. His ability to cut angles, throw punches out of both stances. I mean, not nearly as sharp as Ilia Topuria when cutting angles in the pocket, but you know, landing some big hooks even just around the outside of the guard. Luque is a guy that's known for his high guard, and he'll kind of shell up like this and roll and keep his chin tucked. But Buckley was landing shots behind the ears, around the guard, and throw a hook out of the southpaw, cut the angle, go back to orthodox, fire the right hand out of orthodox. He just looked good. His angle cutting, his speed, his ability to bob and weave into the pocket. He used to have a lot of deficiencies where he would just enter and exit on straight lines. That's kind of how Kevin Holland bonked him in his UFC debut. He just, you know, entered the pocket in a straight line and got waxed for it. Joaquin Buckley is clearly getting better. 3-4 years ago, when Luque was on that like 2019 run of his, 5 years ago, the run lasted longer than that. But you know, when he was beating dudes like Tyron Woodley and Chiesa and Rennie Brown, I would have picked Luque to win that fight. But Luque is a dude. He did not look good against RDA. The RDA fight was a really weird fight because RDA went in there to wrestle, because that's what RDA does, and Luque went in there to strike. And the whole fight got completely flipped upside down because RDA was having all the success with the striking and Luke ended up having all the success with the grappling. And he just doesn't seem like a dude that is confident having to wear damage anymore. And Buckley was winning the fight. He was winning the fight up until that point, but it wasn't like a blowout. And then Luque just shoots a bad takedown. Buckley just pancakes on top of him. Luque ends up pulling guard. And then Buckley just hits him with a shit ton of ground and pound. Some of it, a lot of it was blocked. And he died like an electric toothbrush. He was just there and then gone. The dude pulled guard in 2024 at men's welterweight and then just insta died. He just died right away. It was weird. Like, and then when he got up, he wasn't like all disheveled and out of sorts. You know, he wasn't concussed in any way. He wasn't stumbling. He just got up and was like, that fucking sucked. Obviously, you know, Buckley is a very hard hitter. He can crack, but I don't know, man. Luque fought like a dude that had a brain bleed, was aware of a brain bleed, and was aware of what head trauma does to you. Because he, you know, imagine you the way he got knocked out by Jeff Neal eating a million left hands. It was kind of funny. It was almost like somebody, like a video game, just spamming. But, you know, imagine you get knocked out, you have the brain bleed, you have to go to the hospital, your family's concerned about you, you contemplate retirement, blah, blah. Like, that's something that just never goes away. You can't forget that. These fighters, as savage as they are, you know, they don't get the little men in black thing that they just forget. And it just seemed like he's taking big shots and he's like, I was not able to make this into a wrestling match. I kind of wanted to grapple here. Buckley hits harder. He's faster. He's got really good ground and pound. I don't want to be in here anymore. And I don't like to call fighters quitters, but fuck. I mean, he looked like a dude that was trying to protect his brain. He looked like a dude that was well aware of what head trauma does to him, because he's experienced it firsthand. And if you are going to fight ranked contenders, the dude was supposed to fight Ian Garry. How would that have looked? It would look the same. I mean, Buckley looked great here and, you know, potentially was more dangerous than Ian Garry. I don't know. You look at Ian Garry's last fight, and Buckley this time out looked a lot more dangerous than Ian Garry did his last time out. Different topic. But Luque's getting matched against dangerous dudes. Buckley's a violent finisher. He's got the most violent knockout in UFC history. Ian Garry can be a violent finisher. He's not getting matched against softball dudes. And welterweight is a division full of danger. Everyone there is dangerous. You can go way down. You know, we're going to talk about the UFC Saudi Arabia in the middle segment of the show. But even dudes like D-Rod, like you don't want to be scared of taking head trauma at welterweight with no wrestling game if you're going to be pulling guard and shit. Just not a good look, man. So I think for Luque, he's only like 32, but the miles, it just really, Luque's run was amazing, but it really makes you appreciate dudes like Dustin Poirier who are just able, dudes like even Justin Gaethje, but Dustin Poirier even more so. The dude has just fought everybody and he's still, yeah, he's jumping guillotine and doing dumb shit, but he's also knocking people the F out. And you can't go into a fight at the UFC level with any second. You can't second guess yourself. You can't second guess your durability. If you're concerned about your health, then, and you're concerned about taking damage, and you look the way that Vicente Luque did, in my humble opinion, I don't think you should be taking fights anymore. It's too dangerous. It's just not going to end well for you. Maybe he can hop on UFC Fight Pass. He's a good grappler. Go do some grappling stuff. That's what I think is next for Buckley, or sorry, for Luque. For Buckley, he got himself ranking. I think Luque was going to be ranked number 11. These rankings will come out. The UFC rankings should come out by Tuesday, which is tomorrow, the 2nd of April, when this show will drop. And we'll see where he's at. He should be ranked like number 11, maybe number 12. Curious to see what the UFC does with him. here. I would like to see him fight Jeff Neal. Jeff Neal's coming off a loss. Jeff Neal's a little bit higher in the rankings. Buckley's coming off a win, so something like that would be fun. Maybe a Wonder Boy fight would be kind of dope. But Buckley seems like a character, and he's a violent finisher, and the UFC seems to like him. So I would say that they keep continuing to move him up. He took Sean Brady's place. This was supposed to be Sean Brady. And looking back now, I like Sean Brady. Sean Brady's a good fighter, and he may be a better fighter than Joaquin Buckley, but Joaquin Buckley's definitely more violent and dangerous. So this was kind of, you know, a more dangerous fight for Luque when you think about who he was supposed to replace. But I think Buckley should just now fight Sean Brady, maybe too. I think that makes all the sense in the world. Great win from Joaquin Buckley. I got that one right, thankfully. And it's kind of sad to watch Luque bumping down one fight more on the card. This will be the last fight we talk about for the first segment of the show. We have No USADA, Chris Weidman. I don't want to say beating Bruno Silva. Did he win the first two rounds of the fight? Yes. Did Chris Weidman look unexpectedly good? Yes. Did Chris Weidman win the fight on his record? Yes. Did Chris Weidman eye poke Bruno Silva four times in the fight and only get warnings and then have the first two rounds and the part of the third round scored for him to win this fight? Also, yes. Did the referee Gary Copeland take a point from Herbert Burns after his second foul of the same foul earlier in the night? Also, yes. Should this fight have ended in a DQ or no contest? Also, yes. Chris Weidman looked good, unexpectedly good. And I did not take into account for No USADA Weidman. I only took No USADA Bruno Silva into account. And if you look at Bruno Silva, his, you know, career over at M1 and his early UFC career, number one, this is like the most unreliable dude on the whole roster. You know, he looks like an absolute fucking killer some days, and then some days he just not there. And he dinged up Chris Weidman, but Chris Weidman looked durable. Really telling moment early in the fight, like right in the first 10 seconds of the fight, Chris Weidman fainted a kick and Weidman was right away ready to check it. He threw tons and tons of kicks. His kicking game looked better than it ever did. And I think that shows with his time that he's been spending down in South Carolina with Wonderboy. Wonderboy was in his corner. Weidman's kicking game looked great. Up till now, he had some decent leg kicks, but you know, his most notorious kick was a spinning wheel kick that lost him his belt against Luke Rockhold. Another thing I noticed is Weidman's wrestling is just gone. And it's fine because he can fight these types of fights at middleweight. He's clearly determined to continue fighting. I actually hated all of his post-fight stuff. Not talking about his determination, but the way he just owned eye-poking Bruno Silva. We'll talk about that in a second. But his boxing looked good. His pressure looked good. There was moments where they were exchanging in the pocket, and I expected Chris Weidman to die like 20 times in this fight, and he did not. He got a huge, I mean, his eye was swollen shut, huge black eye, and he fought tough. There was moments where he would march forward and pressure Bruno Silva and crush him with combinations on the against the cage. Weidman can actually, if he continues to look like this, he might be able to do something in this division. Definitely not get into a title fight or something like that. Because there's another 39-year-old in this division that's probably should be fighting for a title, and Jared Cannonier. And I think Jared Cannonier would do bad things to Weidman. Jared Cannonier's leg kicks and just his I think Jared Cannonier would probably kill Chris Weidman today, especially because Weidman can't wrestle anymore. But he could fight, like, I don't know. I mean, Wellington Turman is about 170 now, but he can fight just nobody's, you know. He could fight someone like Andre Petroski or something like that. That was a funny fight. But we're going to talk about the eye pokes. If a foul impacts the fight can potentially be stopped. If you poke someone in the eyes once, you get a warning. You get a firm warning. If you do it again and it impacts the fight, they should take a point. If you do it again after that, you get DQ'd. Gary Copeland was like on this card. He was just all fucking out of sorts. Stopped the Bill Algeo fight pretty early, in my opinion. This fight was just weird. All these finishes all were super weird. Even like the Cedricus Dumas and Nursultan Rizabov fight ended very weird. But he double eye poked Bruno Silva, and Bruno Silva goes crashing to the ground, grabbing his face. My eyes. And there was no shots. Even upon rewatch, I don't understand how they would not at least at a minimum deem this as no contest, because upon rewatch, you gave the dude two warnings prior about the eye pokes. You warned Bruno Silva about eye pokes when he didn't even poke Weidman in the eye. Gary Copeland, after the second eye poke, Bruno Silva was asking for a towel, never fucking brought him the towel. Now the fighters are granted the use of a towel. You can bring him a towel. There should be an eye poke towel like ready at hand at all times. The ref should just have it in his pocket or thrown over his shoulder. Hey, here's a towel for your eye. Wipe it off. Also, another thing that Gary Copeland was doing when Julio Arce got kneed in the balls by Herbert Burns, he's telling him, stretch it out. Did you have balls? You don't stretch balls. It looked like a bat's wing. Like, what? There was a lot of people, fighters and officiants on this card that I would be happy to not see officiate again. I'm okay if Gary Copeland never officiates a UFC fight after this. This was just, after this card, it was terrible. The judge that scored the Reese McKee fight, or the Chidi Njokwani Reese McKee fight for Reese McKee. Reese McKee landed 8 strikes in total between the last two rounds of that fight, and someone gave him that. It's fucking abysmal. And Gary Copeland, the referee's performance in this fight, in my opinion, was fucking abysmal. You can't watch Herbert Burns knee someone in the balls and then go and do it again and take the point from Herbert Burns. And then Chris Weidman have 2 fouls that are potentially, I mean, I have nuts. Getting kicked in the nuts is terrible. I've also hit myself in the eye with a fishing lure and had to go to the emergency room and have to go to the eye doctor and do a bunch of crazy stuff that was very frightening. I'll tell you right now, getting kicked in the balls is absolutely terrible. But 5-10 minutes later, you're okay. You get an eye injury, my left eye was blurry for months. Like, eye injuries can be immediately impactful. With one eye, you lose your depth perception. You lose a lot of stuff. And eye pokes are probably more, you know, impactful on a fight than a kick in the balls. So you watch Chris Weidman poke him in the eye once, firm warning. Poke him in the eye again, and both fighters get a warning. And then the fight ends with a double eye poke from both hands. What do we have instant replay for? This fight should have been deemed a no contest, in my opinion. And I would not. Also, why didn't he take a point and then still go to the cards? Because first it was ruled a TKO stoppage. Then they go back to the cards, review the footage. And then they score the first 2 rounds. And then the part of the third round, because I guess it had been like 15 seconds or whatever the rules are. Part of the third round, they score the third round, and then they give it to Chris Weidman. But after all those fouls, it just leaves such a bad taste in your mouth. And the fouls become blatant if you've been warned that many times. Yeah, the UFC gloves suck, but it's your, you know, the gloves aren't going anywhere. You know the gloves are there. Chris Weidman has fought in the UFC gloves many times. Should the UFC change their gloves to not – the way that those – with the hand wraps, it's very hard to close your fist. You're kind of always like this, and you have to pull tight to close a fist in a UFC glove. So I get it, but – no excuse for it. Terrible officiating from Gary Copeland. Really, really bad. What's the use of the instant replay for? The 2 eye pokes were so bad that they caused the fight to stop. And then at that point, you have a history of these. It's the same foul. It's not like a cage grab, a glove grab, and then an eye poke. It's all eye pokes. Like, you should have taken a point after the second one because you gave him, you warned him. What the fuck are warnings for? Imagine you get pulled over by a cop for speeding. It gives you a warning. Then 10 minutes later, that cop catches you speeding again. He ain't giving you a fucking warning. He's giving you a ticket. You're getting hit right there. That's it. And that could be over days. You get a warning. You get a warning for speeding by a cop. And then a week later, that same cop catches you for speeding again. Hey, I gave you a warning already. Now you're getting the ticket. It just doesn't fucking make sense to me. And it actually kind of irritates me because there's just no congruency. What's the athletic commission for? What are the rules for if you can just break them and get away with it and win fights? You can win two rounds of a fight, have the third round start, fight 30 seconds of the third round, kick your opponent in the balls, opponent can't continue anymore, and then you just win the fight. Everyone should just do that. If you're an MMA fighter listening to this, bank two rounds of a fight, foul out your opponent, and then you just win the fight as long as the third round starts, apparently, and there's some time that elapses. And I hated what Chris Weidman said. He in the post fight in the cage, he said, oh, well, when you get eye poked, you shouldn't fall to the ground like that. You shouldn't eye poke people, bro. Can't defend that. You know, it would be like if someone left their car door open and you see a few hundred dollars laying on the passenger seat and you open the door and you steal it. You still stole it just because the door of the car was unlocked. Yeah, but the car door was unlocked. So, and it's still not supposed to do it. This win from Chris Weidman is probably going to buy him three more violent knockout losses, but whatever, he wants to be here. The UFC loves Chris Weidman. He's still their boy. So I don't even know what to do with him next. Maybe like Marc-Andre Barrio, or if Bo Nickel crushes Cody Brundage, use him to get over Bo Nickel. Or, I mean, there's just a lot of options. He could fight someone like Jacob Malkoon that won earlier on the card. He could fight Andre Petroski. He could fight Gerald Meerschaert. Jared Meerschaert and Chris Weidman actually makes a lot of sense. It's crazy in 2024. But we'll move on. Clearly, I'm frustrated about it. And Bruno Silva, this whole card had like a lot of the worst fighters in the UFC on it. And I could tell this was like spring cleaning. Clearly, it's spring now. It's April. But clearly, this was like spring cleaning for the UFC. We had Cedricus Dumas. With his arrest records and all that, he shouldn't just not be in the UFC, in my opinion, anyway. Cedricus Dumas, we had Reese McKee, we had Anton Tricali, we had Herbert Burns, and we had Bruno Silva. Like, those are some of the worst fighters on the whole roster. So with losses here, they can all just kind of float away. And I'm okay with that. And I'm okay if Bruno Silva floats away as well. And that was the first segment of the show, Out with the Old. We're going to go ahead and move on to the middle segment of the show, What's Hot? And I'm here to talk about the newly announced UFC Saudi Arabia card. It's a terrible time to take a drink of water. I'm sorry. This card will be in Saudi Arabia, and it will be headlined by Khamzat Chimaev versus Robert Whittaker. A very good and very, very tough fight for Khamzat. Co-main event on that will be Sergey Pavlovich versus Alexander Volkov, with a little asterisk next to that because that fight might not even fucking happen based on what I'm seeing in the media. Kelvin Gastelum and D-Rod is on here. Charles Bullitt is on here fighting Ihar Poteria at 185. And we got Johnny Walker versus Volkan Uzdemir. And all these fights are really good fights. Tons of light heavyweights. MMA Mania, I kind of pulled some of the stats from them, but I believe they have this actually marked wrong. The Shara Bullitt versus Ihar Poteria fight is going to be at 185. Poteria has moved down to 185. Could be wrong there. And then the Sergey Pavlovich, Alexander Volkov fight, both of these dudes are like, hey, we're training partners and we're friends and we don't really want to fight. This fight wasn't agreed to. This is a typical UFC thing they did. They did it to Dustin Poirier with BSD, where they announce fights that aren't truly made. And it's very weird because Volkov just got announced as a main event against Jalton Almeida. Interesting. The main event, though, Robert Whittaker versus Khamzat Chimaev, that's a real good fight, like real, real good fight. Robert Whittaker, just the guy's fought fucking everybody. He is a soldier. He's a soldier for the UFC. He's a soldier in life. The battles with, fought Izzy twice, Yoel Romero twice, DDP. The dude's just Jared Cannonier. He's fought everyone. Everyone, starting from his loss to Wonderboy at 170, the dude has still faced just a crazy, crazy amount of high level dudes, all championship level guys. And then you have Khamzat Chimaev, who's coming off of a nice win over Kamaru Usman, where he absolutely dominated him. He took him down four times. Usman had only ever been taken down once in his career prior to that. Yeah, it was up at 185 on short notice, and he was slotted to face Paulo Costa. Well, Robert Whittaker just beat Paulo Costa in a great fight where Paulo Costa probably looked his best ever, and Whittaker was coming off of that violent finish loss to DDP. It's going to be five rounds. Can Khamzat make it five rounds? I don't know. Going back to earlier last year, I picked Khamzat Chimaev as my middleweight fighter for the MMA fantasy matchmaking, whatever it was called that we did. And I'm not as confident as I was at that time. Robert Whittaker could could definitely win this fight, and so could Khamzat Chimaev. Don't love that Khamzat has now left Sweden and is in the UAE training full time. I think that is due to his dealings with some high Chechenian leader. I won't even speak on it because I don't like to talk about that because it's kind of scary. But Khamzat has some dealings with some Chechenian leader that the UFC and Sweden, I mean, clearly America doesn't like him because he can't get into this country to fight. And seems like clearly Sweden didn't like those dealings either. Don't blame them. The whole card's an amazing card, and they'll continue to add on there. It was funny because the Gaziev Rosenstrike card was supposed to be the UFC's Saudi Arabia card, and the UFC, like, it's like if you buy something real shitty from the store and you return it when you realize it's a piece of shit. That's what the Saudis did to the UFC. They're like, no, we don't want this card here. Bring us a real card, especially with all the boxing that they brought there. I mean, they just had Francis versus Joshua. They had Francis versus Fury. The Saudis are dumping tons and tons of money into combat sports. It looks like they're trying to up their tourism and up their they want people to live there too, apparently. I wouldn't live there, but it's my opinion. Yeah, just an all-around great card. I'm interested to see Shara Bullitt fight again. I'm actually interested to see what Ihor Pulteria looks like at 185. Kelvin Gastelum versus D-Rod is a great fight. And if Pavlovich and Volkov stay on the card together, that's a great fight too. Can Pavlovich go out there and ice Volkov? Or can Volkov, you know, be a tactful technical striker and, you know, overcome someone that has such big dangerous power as Pavlovich? It's a great card. Tell me what you guys think in the comments. I'm pretty hyped for this. Curious on what time this card will start. I'm personally in the West Coast. I live in the wonderful state of Washington. So I'm just curious to see what time they do this at. It'll be interesting. That's all I've got for the middle segment of the show. So we're going to move on to In With The New here in just a moment. All right, everyone. Final segment of the show, In With The New. We're going to talk about the UFC fight night coming up this Saturday. We have Chris Curtis taking on Brendan Allen. And the reason why I said it's number two. And the reason why I say Chris Curtis's name first is because he's the one that won last time, and he won via pretty violent knockout. And interesting enough, that was Allen's last loss on his major win streak. Before we talk about the main event, we're going to talk about the co-main event. We're only going to talk about two fights today. I'm going to spend a little bit more time tape studying and really trying to put some good, really good together for UFC 300. So I'm sorry you're not getting three fights, and there's not many fights on this card this weekend. Alexander Hernandez taking on Damon Jackson. Odds on that fight, we have Alexander Hernandez as a almost 2-1 favorite. He is a minus 192 favorite, while Damon Action Jackson comes back at plus 160. I don't like Alexander Hernandez's nickname, the Great Ape. But that's his business, not mine. Yeah, Alexander Hernandez is a guy that's coming off of... he's had such a wishy-washy UFC career. Like, the dude got way over elevated when he hopped in and knocked out Benil Dariush on short notice in his UFC debut, and then he went out there and beat OAM, and then at that point the UFC was like, you deserve a big fight, let's give you Cowboy. He was chatting all that shit to Cowboy that you guys all remember, and he got fucking head kicked for it. After that, he went and beat Francisco Trinaldo, which that's in 2019. Francisco Trinaldo is a pretty good win. And he got knocked out by Drew Dober. So they're like, hey, let's give you a you know, fight down. Chris Gritzmacher, probably the ugliest person in the UFC, or was in the UFC at the time, knocks out Chris Gritzmacher. They're like, okay, we'll give you another pretty good fight. Give him Thiago Moises. He loses Thiago Moises. Then he's like, okay, let's give you Mike Breeden, because we can't figure out where you are, and neither can you. He knocks out Mike Breeden. Then at that point, he gets rear naked choked by Renato Moicano. And okay, he's going to move down a division. Then he takes on Billy Q and gets finished by Billy Q, where he looked good, and then he did the typical thing where he faded. Beats Jim Miller. That was a good fight. Good fight by both guys. And Jim Miller's a dog. He looked good there. And then he looked really good his last time out against Bill Algeo. And he lost that fight. So we don't – I'm still – I went through his UFC record with you guys, and I still like don't know where Alexander Hernandez is. I know who he is, and I know what he's good at, and I know what his plus and minuses are. But like, I still don't know where he fits in the UFC. This is down at featherweight. I just don't know where he fits into the division. And maybe if you're listening to this, throw it in the comments and tell me where you think he sits. Because I don't know if he's the 30th ranked featherweight, or the 20th, or the 100th. I don't know. And he could come out here and absolutely fucking wreck Damon Jackson, or he could win the first round and then die in the third. We just don't know. And Damon Jackson is kind of in a similar place. Like, he got highlighted by a Movly Kubilaev. That was in the PFL, that jump knee. That was back in 2019. And then he fought in the LFA. Came over and he fought Mirsad Bektic, and he choked him out. Got knocked out by Ilia Topuria in 2020. Ilia Topuria is the current champ, man. And then he went on a pretty good run. He beat Charles Rosa, finished Kamala Kirk, beat Dan Argueta, and knocked out Pat Sabatini. He looked really good against Dan Argueta. Dan Argueta did come up a division and took the fight on short notice, but he looked good. And then I think his brother had just died, and then he went out there and just fucking flattened Pat Sabatini. He was billed to me as someone that was a lot better than he probably is. I don't think Pat Sabatini's that good. But he went out there and knocked him out. Then he got knocked out by Dan Ige, swinging hooks in the pocket with Ige. Not a good idea. And he lost a decision to Billy Q in a very Billy Q fight. This is a good co-main event because both of these guys can be very fucking violent and finish dudes in violent ways, and they can also be finished in violent ways. And I think the UFC matchmakers actually did a great job with this fight. Damon Jackson has not fought in quite a while. Sorry, I am dropping my phone, which I'm using as a template for notes. I got the phone stand right here, and it fell off the stand, so I apologize. And I'm not going to ask for that to be cut out. He last fought in August of 2023. That is Damon Jackson. So it's been a little bit of time. Been quite a while, actually. And Alexander Hernandez fought October of 23 when he lost to Bill Algeo. Alexander Hernandez is a dude that he's big. He's athletic. He's strong. He, you know, he's like a whole shot fighter. Out the hole, he's powerful, you know, swings big hooks. He's technical. He's got a good kicking game, got a decent boxing game. And if he's not forced to face adversity, he could murk a lot of people. He's very good. But at the UFC level, I mean, if Alexander Hernandez was just like a regional fighter, he would have so many violent first round finishes just because his athleticism, his speed, and his power. And on the regional level, like, you're just going to fucking fold people with just those attributes. But at the UFC level, like, that's what regional MMA is for. It's to filter out all the people that just, you know, you could be the best MMA fighter in the world, but if you can't take a punch, you can't take a punch. And that's what the regional level is for. Dudes like Damon Jackson, yeah, he's been knocked out before, but that's Ilya fucking Topuria. And Dan Ige, a very hard puncher. And he had some success in the Dan Ige fight for as short as it was before he got finished. Here in this fight, I'm very on the fence with it because Alexander Hernandez cutting down to 145, he looked good against Bill Algeo. And Damon Jackson has a lot of a very similar game to Algeo, where he can just make things sticky, you know, and he's got good volume. He will punch the body. He will move forward. Damon Jackson really loves to leave his head on the center line, and he does not have good striking defense. And someone like Alexander Hernandez could totally make him pay for that. Damon Jackson's got really good BJJ, and he's a decent wrestler, but on the ground, he's got good scrambles, and he's just got really good, really good submission game. That's something he's known for. That's his thing. And if someone wins in the first round, it's going to be Alexander Hernandez just getting him out of there, because Damon Jackson is very defensively porous, and Alexander Hernandez, you know, on the front foot, can be extremely violent. On the other hand, at 145, if Damon Jackson pushes the pace, withstands the first round, and starts turning this into a grappling match, he could totally take the wind out of Alexander Hernandez's sails. And going into this fight, I kind of was really leaning Alexander Hernandez to just have some prolonged exchanges and just hurt Damon Jackson with something. But the more I think of it, we kind of know what we have with Damon Jackson, and he may be a little wishy-washy, but like, Alexander Hernandez is the definition of a wishy-washy ass fighter where you just don't know. 2-1 favorite. Like, I'm not a betting man. I don't sports bet anymore. I used to sports bet. And if I was still sports betting, I might place a little something on Damon Jackson here, and maybe by submission or like in the third round, just because Alexander Hernandez is a wishy-washy ass dude. And the second he starts facing adversity, he has melted before when he's forced to face adversity. It's probably a bad pick, but I'm going to pick Damon Jackson to win by third round submission, as long as he doesn't get absolutely iced in the first round. And he probably will get absolutely iced in the first round. But as an underdog with that line, you know, odds on this fight, Alexander Hernandez is minus 192. Damon Jackson's at plus 160. You could probably find like +500 or +600 him in the third round or him by submission. I feel like that is a pretty reasonable bet with a really good number attached to it. Still on the fence. I do feel like Alexander Hernandez could and should probably go out there and finish him in the first round, but I'll just pick Damon Jackson because I got no money on the line, and I think it'll be interesting if he wins. And if this fight, I'll feel a lot better about my pick if we get 7.5 minutes into this fight and Damon Jackson is not dead yet. All right, guys, we got the main event, and it is a rematch, a short notice rematch. We have the number 6 middleweight taking on the number 14th middleweight, Chris Curtis versus Brendan Allen. Chris Curtis is the underdog here, plus 164. We got Brendan Allen coming in at minus 198. So 2-1 favorite, Brendan Allen here. This kid is on a hell of a fucking streak, man. And he has been looking pretty damn good, maybe fighting some lesser opponents, but he's on a 6-fight win streak. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And his last loss was his knockout loss, the punches and knees to Chris Curtis in the second round of their bout. That was in December 4th of 21. Since then, he beat Sam Alvey. In my opinion, he probably should have lost to Jacob Malkoon, but Jacob Malkoon is like kind of like the sleeper cell Bilal Muhammad of this division. Like, he's just pretty fucking good everywhere and like has good fight IQ. He rear naked choke Jocko, who went to the PFL and tested for PEDs. Rear naked choke Andre Muniz, who is a dude that I feel like is a front runner. Rear naked choke Bruno Silva, who we just saw this weekend, and then he rear naked choked Paul Craig. The dude has rear naked choked 1, 2, 3, 4 dudes in a row. Are all four of those dudes very high level guys? I'll let you decide that. Should he be ranked number 6 in the division after rear naked choking all those dudes? I don't know. Is Brendan Allen a busted prospect because he got knocked out by Sean Strickland and Chris Curtis back in 2020 and 2021? No, he's not. Is he a good fighter? He is. Should he be ranked number 6 in the division? I don't know. Chris Curtis, on the other hand, he is a dude that is coming off of a split decision win against Marc-Andre Barriol, where it was a clean win, in my opinion. And he's a much better fighter than Marc-Andre Barriol. But Chris Curtis has that young veteran, just that veteran mentality where if he's not getting lumped up, getting dropped, or, you know, he rolls the punches and things sometimes look like they hurt him maybe, or they land cleaner more than they do. And he just was better than Marc-Andre Barriol everywhere. And he is better than Marc-Andre Barriol everywhere. And it shouldn't have gone. He just shouldn't have allowed a fight that close to happen. Prior to that, he had that head clash with Nasruddin Imavov in a pretty close fight up until that point. He lost against Kelvin Gastelum, but he also was a victim of another head clash and that lost him the fight. Should have won that Kelvin Gastelum fight. And minus the head clash, would have probably won. Knocked out Joaquin Buckley. Lost to Jack Hermanson in a fight where he was really angry and upset by Jack Hermanson's tactics. The decision over Rodolfo Vieira is still like one of his best performances. And then the knockout against Brendan Allen and then Phil Hawes before that were two really good performances. What do these guys do really well? Brendan Allen is a good kicker. Very defensively porous, though. He has been training with Henry Hooft. But he does have a tendency to drop his hands and exit the pocket. He does try to do a lot of leaning and tall guy stuff, but he's got a big head. And he's just not the most durable guy. And he's one of those dudes that, like, when he gets hit, he seems to get hit pretty clean. Definitely not the defensive striker that Chris Curtis is at all. But he's got a hellacious scramble game, pretty fucking good takedowns, a real good back take game. And real good BJJ. He's like the Pantoja of this fucking division. On top, he's a menace. When he takes your back, he's an absolute menace. His kicking game is very good. I've heard Ben Duffy, you know, say something along the lines of that it reminds him of Luke Rockhold. And I could see that with the kicking game and the good BJJ and the good top game and the good control. I could totally see that. And even with like the propensity to just get knocked the fuck out and be kind of defensively porous, that makes sense. Very big for this division. He's a young dude and he's fought everybody. You go look at his LFA, he's, you know, Trevin Giles, Fluffy Hernandez, Eric Anders. Like, those are dudes he fought before he hit the UFC, which is just bizarre. He's still so young. And for him to be ranked number 6 in this division, I don't really agree with the ranking, but I don't get a say in that. It's the UFC's rankings. Should he be in the top 15? Yes. Chris Curtis, what is he good at? Very good defensive wrestler. That's not his best skill, but I'm just going to start with the wrestling. Good defensive wrestler. Very good down blocking. he's very good at digging in under hooks and shucking opponents off and cutting angles. You know, if you get in on a single, he will fire that underhook in quickly, try to kill that underhook and just get out of there, circle the pocket, and then just, you know, re-enter into striking. That's what he likes to do. He's got a good sprawl, pretty good offensive takedowns as well, and he'll use them when needed, but he's not going to do that against Brendan Allen here. Really crafty boxer, and he's a real good body puncher. And I love that he's a body puncher and he utilizes body punching to take the wind out of his opponent's sails and go to up top. He's got good power. He's not the most powerful dude, but what helps him win a lot of striking exchanges are his composure, his ability to roll with punches and not get hurt by them, even though that's visually, optically not good for the judges in MMA. It's not boxing. But he doesn't take a ton of damage, especially in the UFC. He hasn't taken a ton of damage in the UFC, and he's fought pretty good dudes. But his precision, his boxing and his precision are like, the way he throws his body punches are like chef's kiss. They're fucking beautiful. And the way he uses them to set up his shots up top, his composure in the pocket, is those are all of his things where he excels. But he is a little bit small for this division, and he struggles with guys that have good footwork. He had a really hard time cutting off the cage and tracking down Jack Hermanson, which kind of surprised me. And he got really frustrated. He's a guy that will get down on himself and will get frustrated in a fight if things don't go his way. And I don't like that here. I could see him getting his back taken in this fight and just being like, fuck it, the hell with it. This sucks. I don't want to be here anymore. Dude's got he's like a 55 veteran. And he's kind of seems to be a guy that's in his way where he wants fights to happen under his terms. And if they don't, he doesn't like it. Another thing I don't like that Chris Curtis does is his, he's just a little bit too low volume. Like against Joaquin Buckley, he lost the first round, made his read, and then just knocked him the F out. Where it's like, dude, up the volume. Same thing against Marc-Andre Barriault. Another thing Chris Curtis does really well is his dirty boxing. His overhook and then just fucking uppercut the shit out of you, hockey style. He's really, really good there. He will get the overhook, throw a couple of dirty boxing punches, throw a couple uppercuts, and then tie clinch, boom, boom, throw some knees. He's really good at that too. Brendan Allen is a pretty big favorite here, even though he got knocked out by Chris Curtis, but that was 3 years ago. And what's crazy is the deficiencies that Brendan Allen showed and got exposed by Chris Curtis in their first fight, I don't know if those have changed. And has Chris Curtis gotten older? Yes. Has he had closer fights with guys that he's better than since then? Yes. But he's still a dog. If he can, and over five rounds, I'm not concerned. And I'm not concerned about either one of these dudes in over five rounds. I'll just say that now. But Chris Curtis has had a lot of five round experience in his career. The dude's a champion of every fucking regional MMA organization there is. I was watching him fight XMMA in Miami 5 years ago. Both of these dudes are Contender Series alumni. However, only one of them got a contract off the Contender Series. The Chris Curtis Contender Series thing is still mind-blowing, just stupid how the UFC didn't give him a contract. But here he is now, main eventing for them. Tough fight to call, because if they strike, if this becomes a striking match where Brendan Allen can utilize his kicks, he's got good dexterity with his kicks, good leg kicks. He's crushing Sean Strickland with leg kicks. If he uses his leg kicks, he can have a lot of success. Where he's defensively porous is in prolonged exchanges in the pocket, where he'll start trying to pull on punches and he doesn't cut very good angles. And, you know, he will get hurt by guys like Chris Curtis and Sean Strickland. And those are the places that Chris Curtis can succeed. I think Chris Curtis really only has one way to win this fight, and that's boxing in the pocket. And I think Brendan Allen could utilize good footwork and land kicks from the outside and potentially not even need to grapple. I could see Brendan Allen really trying to, and I said this about Aaron Blanchfield, to just walk into Chris Curtis, jab him into the cage, make Chris Curtis take the back foot, force him into the cage, and then start some back takes there, or maybe get some single leg takedowns going, smush him into the cage, force some scrambles, take the back and get the rear naked choke. I could totally see that happening. Brendan Allen is extremely confident. Chris Curtis isn't always a confident guy. They both come from really good camps. This is a really good fight. I think the short notice aspect of it, it's on about 3 weeks notice, also plays into the odds as well. Sorry, the silence is not good for air, but I think I'm going to pick another underdog in an upset just because I can come eat crow on the show again next week anyway and say I was wrong. But I think Brendan Allen's overconfidence has got him caught in the past, and I could just see it happening again, especially over five rounds. Chris Curtis is a builder. He is a dude like he's kind of got that like Chito Vera in him where like he can hang in a fight, make his reads and then just end you. And this could end up being like a 49-46 or like a 48-47. That's a really fun fight. And Brendan Allen wins it because he gets a couple rounds and gets a back take and gets some back control, you know, a la Aljamain Sterling. You know, he could win a fight like Aljo. But beating Paul Craig, who is a dangerous fighter in his own right, but a completely different game in Chris Curtis. Beating Bruno Silva is Bruno Silva. Beating Andre Muniz, very different game than Chris Curtis. The dudes that have given Brendan Allen the most trouble are the dudes that have had just prolonged pocket boxing fights. Sean Strickland, Chris Curtis did it once already. I could just totally see this ending this the same way again. And it's I hate to pick a guy that has one route to victory over a guy that has like three or four routes to victory. But Brendan Allen hasn't fought a dude like Chris Curtis since he fought Chris Curtis. He's fought Sam Alvey. Jacob Malkoon is a wrestler. Jocko is just not good. Andre Muniz has shown to be a front runner with a grappling game. Bruno Silva is the most unreliable dude on the roster, probably not on the roster anymore. And Paul Craig is another dude that's extremely defensively porous in the striking and is a BJJ guy. He's beating guys at their own game that are grapplers. Like Malkoon, grappler. Jocko is just an MMA guy that's not very good. He's an anomaly. But Andre Muniz and Paul Craig were two really dominant, really impressive wins. But those two dudes are grapplers, and they're not strikers like Chris Curtis. Chris Curtis has good defensive wrestling, and Chris Curtis, you give him an inch and he will take a mile. If you let him make his reads, he can hurt you. And I just don't think Brendan Allen has the same footwork or speed as Jack Hermanson. And I don't think he is as calculated as Jack Hermanson. We saw Jack Hermanson just recently against Joe Pfeiffer utilize his high fight IQ. And I just don't think Brendan Allen is there yet. Could be totally wrong. Chris Curtis is the pick for me. That's the show, guys. There's the sign. Check the kick. There's a UFC belt. Like, subscribe, comment to SureDog. Comment on this if you guys like it. Please, I appreciate all of you guys for listening. The likes, the subscribers, the comments, it helps our algorithm here at SureDog. So I really, really appreciate you guys. I'm Devin. Check the kick, SureDog.com. Enjoy the fights.